Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and guests. I apologize for the slightly disorganized presentation. I had to listen to everything and try to put it together on the spot, thinking on my feet, as our colleague Amy said the other day. I guess it was only yesterday, feels like a week ago. But I will do my best to start with, I will start with Iraq. I will go through what's at stake in this plan. I will give some comments on the plan, and I will return to Iraq. Iraq was the reason for holding these series of tribunals. This is the first tribunal, and it had both a charge to present some sort of foundation work, but also to specifically address Iraq. I think the first question, particularly in light of the actions of the PNAC and how the Bush administration has proceeded, is why Iraq? And there's a very simple question, a very simple answer to that: who else? And from the testimony we've heard in the last 2 days, it's obvious why Iraq at this juncture. For one thing, the PNAC plan is about resources. Iraq has oil. The water, which was raised fortunately today, is also a critical issue in this. Three, Iraq was the headstone, so to speak, of the Pan-African concept, which had to be destroyed if there was to be success in the PNAC plan. Iraq was the most likely country ripe for this kind of action to power its own economy and also the surrounding region. That was the fourth reason. Fifth, weapons testing. The United States is always looking for places to test its weapons and use its weapons in actual combat. Ramsey Clark pointed out that the development of new weapons that have been tried yet put us all at risk, because indeed they will be tested, and then they need to be tested in real life. Depleted uranium weapons were already tested for the first time in a major way in the first Gulf War. The United States knew the outcome and needed to test depleted uranium weapons again to see if in some way they could be contained or if their own troops could be better protected. So in a sense, it had to be Iraq. Iraq was already wasted vis-a-vis depleted uranium, and just in case depleted uranium is as bad as we all know it is, it didn't want to contaminate another place yet. Plus the fact that the wind pattern in Iraq was perfect for testing weapons that might have the liability that they have, because the next country over is, guess who? Iran. And so using depleted uranium in Iraq was the best place to avoid polluting a potential friend. Six, Iraq was a test in how far they could go to undermine the United Nations. This is a very important point, because the administration had built such a division in the international arena on this issue, and the United States was determined to do its very, very best all along the line to discredit the United Nations, which has been important for their agenda. Iraq was the perfect place to do it. Then when you add the sanctions, it was Iraq, because the United States needed to know how far they could go destroying a civilian population, a people, without the United Nations as a whole or the international community as a whole stopping them. They had made such a pariah of Saddam Hussein that they felt that they wanted to see how far they could go attacking the Iraqi people before people would say, I don't care how bad Saddam Hussein is, you can't do that anymore. And it lasted 12 years. It was the proper judgment from their perspective. And the eighth point on this, why Iraq? What other country could be used that would best allow the United States to manipulate completely the media? By having the sanctions regime, by having the characterization of Saddam Hussein as a tyrant, the press was intimidated to question anything about the situation in Iraq. So this is a summation of what we've heard in the last 2 days about why Iraq put all in one little basket. There are, of course, other reasons, peripheral reasons, supporting reasons, collateral reasons, but these were the main threads, and I think it's very important that we put them all together and look, because when we see the maps our dear colleague has done, Monsieur Colon, and we look at other potential places, the Iraq lesson will show us probably the most likely next places, the next spots. And I would suggest that one of them perhaps might be the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We should very definitely look there. We should also be alert to possibilities in terms of Burma, other places where with a control of an area in a similar way to Iraq, the PNAC agenda can be fulfilled. The other side of the coin we've just heard a great deal about from Ramsey Clark, but it has been a thread in a number of presentations. And I generally call this thread, what is at stake if the international community lets the United States get away with the PNAC agenda, whatever we want to call it. Well, I want to call it the Bush-Cheney agenda. So if I may, I will call it the Bush-Cheney agenda until I'm specifically addressing PNAC as a whole. What is at stake? Well, the first thing that goes is the post-World War vision of the realization of people's aspirations as best characterized in the United Nations Charter, but also in a kind of renewed intention of the international community to redesign and restructure itself to prevent, as the UN Charter says, the scourge of war. In addition to that, there are fundamental principles of international law from the Charter itself, including, as Mr. Clark indicated, the definition of aggression, the obligations of the United Nations Charter, and declarations under the United Nations Charter of direct relevancy to the Bush-Cheney plan, declarations such as the Declaration of Friendly Principles, how states are to act with each other to prevent the scourge of war, the Charter on the Economic Rights and Duties of States, how states are to engage in their economic development and allow the economic development in other states to prevent the scourge of war. And then finally, through the United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights, how states are to treat its own citizens and persons under its jurisdiction to prevent the scourge of war. These are all at extreme risk today and have been for quite some time. Are we really ready to shred the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the United Nations Charter, and all its instruments and throw them away? In addition, what's at stake is the whole area of law which was the first area of international law, the law of armed conflict. The law of armed conflict is the first area of international discourse that was subject to agreements and treaties between states, warring parties, and powers. With the tragedy of the Battle of Solferino the century before the last century, we began to have a process of putting on paper rules that would prevent savage butchery in war that was not necessary to win the objects of war, of the objectives of war, and we began to put on paper ways to help victims of armed conflict, and particularly the first Geneva Convention was to protect victims of armed conflict. Shortly after that, we began the first conventions that address specific weapons that are just deemed too bad to use. And in that line, we have a whole number of treaties and agreements and concepts which lets us decide what weapons are simply too bad to use in war. The first one was the Declaration of St. Petersburg in 1868. With the promulgation of the Hague Convention, first in 1899, and its second version with regulations in 1907, we have the first on-paper regulation of how wars may be fought. So in addition to protecting victims of armed conflict, beginning to control the weapons of armed conflict, we're now governing how wars are fought. The Hague Convention. That convention, by the way, also included some prohibitions against new forms of weapons that had been generated since the Declaration of St. Petersburg, and there was a prohibition against poison weapons or methods of warfare using poisons. Then throughout the 20s and the 30s, there were improvements in the Geneva conventions. There were additional conventions on different forms of weaponry. And then we had World War II. Post-charter, there was a determined effort to revamp humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, and a certain degree the Hague Convention, although that didn't happen exactly then, to also prevent the scourge of war, and if war broke out, to keep it as humane as possible, because it is the activity of human nature that threatens most the planet and people. So we have the four Geneva Conventions of 1949, which add an enormously important concept, the protection of the civilian population in times of armed conflict, the inability to target civilians of armies without it being viewed as a crime. We also had the beginning of the treaties to limit nuclear war, nuclear weapons, because of their use in World War II. We risk losing these standards. They have been crudely and daily violated by the United States in carrying out its activities in and against Iraq. And the United States claims no accountability. One of the features that frustrates lawyers in the United States more than anything is an almost unscalable wall of inability to bring domestic lawsuits in the United States for actions such as these. But this is what's at stake as far as the legal regime of the international community that has more or less allowed us to survive post-World War II until now, although we're sort of stumbling a bit along the road. Then we've listened to discussions about what else is at stake and what's at stake for the rest of the world in addition to the United States people themselves. Well, one of the things we've heard is that the Bush-Cheney plan converts, for the most part, middle and lower middle classes into working class or lower and working classes into poverty classes, and the upper echelons of the wealthy class into yet more super wealthy people. I call it the third world as worldization of the United States, but the targets of third worldization do not only include the citizens of the United States who are not in that upper echelon, but it also includes people in Europe and, in a sense, people around the world who have to somehow fit into the pattern. We also have, for the rest of the world, for all of us, a vision of a world that's essentially devoid of concern for social justice. We have heard the argument about the use of human rights as swords of empire. It's very important to understand all this. Imagine having law, world law dictated by the United States that has in it absolutely no concept of social justice. Then we have to look at the phenomena of terrorism. And are we making, is this Bush-Cheney plan making us safer or more at risk of terrorism? Well, this is a twofold discussion. We only had little snippets, and I'm building a teeny bit on the snippets because it's an extremely important point. First of all, you have the what happens in a terrorist act. A terrorist act is a replacement for the ability to have a military operation that has any reasonable sense of success. We have to look at why that type of act. And by the way, there is a prohibition of terrorism in armed conflict as well. So in a sense, those who are as guilty of terrorism are those who carried out shock and awe, as Ramsey Clark let us know, and as I repeatedly say, the very term shock and awe is meant to instill terror. And the threat of those weapons is meant to instill terror. It's meant to thwart the will of people because they're too afraid of the consequence. They did it anyway to warn the next guys. But one element of terrorism we must confront is that when it is impossible to defend oneself using the normal traditional methods of history, which is armed conflict, if it comes to that, a levée en masse, a mass uprising against oppression, resisting country A that comes into country B, the traditional ways of doing that have been armed conflict. Now the balance in weaponry, in equipment, in style, and in intention to even comply with minimum rules is completely askew. And it makes possibilities of terrorism more likely because what else have they got? Then you also have to see through, pierce through the labeling anyway. And this is useful because when it comes to looking for the next location, it is useful to look at places where there has been rebellion against oppression inside a country or because of another country dominating when it doesn't belong there and people resist. If you go through the United States terrorist list, you will see a lot of these groups on the terrorist list. One of them was the opposition in Iran, who had a small base over the border in Iraq. By the way, I should let everyone know, those 4,000 soldiers are now controlled completely by the United States. They were uninvolved in the situation in Iraq. The United States is any minute now, unless we do something about it, going to send 4,000 people over the border, disarmed, over the border into Iran, into the waiting rifles of the Mullah regime. Now, this group was considered too progressive to actually be freedom fighters. So the United States conveniently labeled them terrorist. And I think if you go through the list of who's on and who's not on the terrorist list, you will see the political agenda loud and clear. We have to be very, very careful of even maintaining what we have as far as definition and uses of armed conflict versus terrorism to avoid mislabeling. We also heard implications of involvement of a supposedly known terrorist group called Al-Qaeda that might previously have been acting in the interests of the United States. I work some with the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Terrorism of the United Nations, and in our research for her reports, we have found lots of indications of this. And when you look once again at Monsieur Collomb's map of the southern flank of the former USSR, the Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan, when you look at the oil road and the maps, begins to make sense. I'm not saying yes or no, but I would bet that perhaps Al-Qaeda operatives may very well be in a number of those countries, and it's been alleged that they have been fomenting exactly the kind of action that generates the United States reaction. Now I'm going to move a little to Pax Americana, which has been discussed. I'm going to add the term which I prefer, which is Lex Americana. I believe I heard someone say that, or maybe I just misheard them saying Pax Americana. But I think Lex Americana is really where it's at. I want to make sure everyone here knows this is an addition that I'm bringing in because of the terrorist argument, et cetera, but also because of this Lex Americana idea. The United States insisted that the Security Council establish a committee under the Security Council called the Counterterrorism Committee. The Counterterrorism Committee has a charge to make sure the national legislation of every country, the operating principles of all the Inter-American, African Unity, OIC, Arab League, all the regional organizations, CSCE, Council of Europe, and the community, along with international monetary agencies such as the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and thousands of lesser, all have rules, regulations, and laws for counterterrorism measures that pass the test of this committee. And guess who were the drafters and organizers and controls of what these tests are? It started with Jeremy Greenstock. I started to say Greenspan, but that's it. Greenstock of the UK. It passed on to a Spaniard. My guess is there will no longer be a Spaniard in that position based on current events in Spain. But this counterterrorism committee is requiring all states to submit their legislation for counterterrorism so to all conform. And it's all conforming to Lex Americana. Now I want to talk about PNAC a little bit. I'm not an expert in PNAC. I have watched organizations that start as sort of almost clandestine planning policy groups try to sanitize their image and look more like a normal think tank. I have a suspicion about PNAC, given who's founding it and their current positions in the Bush-Cheney administration, that in fact it really never was that committed to this notion that is scattered about human rights and social justice in their plan, and that was a guise to get people outside their little coterie to submit papers to it, to legitimize it, to give it a kind of cachet. I'm not saying yes or no, but I think it's something that the Commission really ought to look into to the degree it can in this report and at least give some alerts. There have been some indications from witnesses, and these indications have been countered by other witnesses and defense, but I do think it's a very important point to look into because it's a method and mechanism that has been used regularly in many other situations. It has been used to create human rights organizations that aren't really human rights organizations, but have that as their intent, and then those organizations or even individuals end up infiltrating and spying and entering into the fray, so to speak, to the benefit of the governments involved, and in this case, mostly the United States. I'm going back to another aspect of the plan, and that is the significance of the state of exception in this plan. There is already a formula in human rights law for when you have a genuine threat in your country. You can partially suspend certain rights, but there are other rights that you can never suspend. The United States version of this is we can suspend whatever law we want to, whenever we want to, for whatever reason we want to. This was described by, I believe, Mr. Von Sponik in the Richard Pearl statement, international law stands in the way of American interests. But I would add to that, Richard Pearl would also say, the United States Bill of Rights and Constitution stands in the way of American interests. And I would also posit that the internal laws of France and Germany and Belgium and any other country who has a policy that will perhaps prevent that country from ultimately buckling is also in the way of American interests. And although we didn't have a lot of time to address this issue, particularly of the state of exception, there is a document in the book that I would urge the Commission to look at and look at the implications. I want to also talk about the fact, going back to Iraq, and a little bit on the notion of mercenaries and privatization. So now we're back in Iraq. Okay, we're looking at why Iraq. We've looked at kind of the international law that's all at stake and what's being maneuvering around. I want to bring up now, going back to Iraq, this issue of mercenary soldiers. And one of the reasons for having mercenary soldiers is to absolutely avoid implications under the Geneva Convention, because mercenaries are not protected or chargeable under Geneva Conventions. They could, of course, be charged with crimes if they commit crimes, but it's another way of avoiding application of the obvious applicable law in Iraq. Then, as a kind of final point that's leading into areas where we might actually be able to propose actions or initiatives, even though small, that could help unfold and help in situation and also give guidance to the future tribunals that are going to come along. There are several extremely urgent situations in Iraq which puts to test a lot of this, and one of them in particular is the situation of the detainees in Iraq. The detainees that are Iraqi, the detainees that would be officially POWs, those that are officially Iraqi civilians, in addition the Irani detainees, we don't know the numbers, we don't know where they are, they haven't been receiving the kind of visits they should, but we know they number at least 4,000 Iranis, and of the others we don't know, but the numbers are high. If there is an issue that may galvanize to generate a kind of international pressure or action on the United States, I'm proposing this may be one of them. And this forum and the Commission should at least try to target several other areas of action for information, for rallying, that could be used to galvanize international attention and action. I think the particular position of prisoners of war is sensitive because the United States doesn't actually want to abandon the concept of prisoners of war when it's their own prisoners. And so some sort of campaign or message about one of the reasons to demand that the detainees in Iraq are given fair treatment, including the POWs, is because we have armed forces and it's to benefit the U.S. armed forces as well as any other armed forces. If the United States doesn't comply, why should anyone else? And then we really do, if I may be so bold, bottom out on humanitarian law. Ramsey Clark kind of almost stole what I was going to use for conclusion when he made a reference to the United States being so proud to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, which is in our national anthem. But I'm going to paraphrase it using the phrase from our speaker this afternoon. The United States risks being the land of the foolish puppets and the home of the meek. And I think that is the point that Ramsey Clark made that I want to really emphasize. Americans do need help. They need help from this forum. They need help from the continuing pattern of the forum, because Americans have become the meek.
at home.
In spite of the numbers in the marches and in spite of statements from prominent people, I'm ashamed to say America has become the home of the meek. If you look at the degree of challenge of the Democrats, I think you will agree. We need to give those who challenge this administration backbone. We need to do that in spite of the fact we know the groups who try are targeted, the American Civil Liberties Union, Action, many groups involved in trying to educate and bring information to the American people are targeted. But I would appeal to the Commission to find ways to help restore the mission of the United States to its own people as the land of the free and the home of the brave, and to help us make sure that everyone else in the world can operate and generate in their own country, their own lands of the free and home of the brave. Thank you.
Thank you. The word is due.